Aloha, I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 22nd. Today, we look at prescription drug prices. A bill on the governor's desk would help lower costs. We take a tour of a Honolulu brewery that took home medals at the Olympics of beer. How do tariffs affect the company's future? We hear from one shopper who's noticed rising prices on one of his favorite items. And we get the latest from a temporary housing development on Maui for the fire survivors. Plus, this weekend sees the return of Lilo and Stitch to the big screen. We hanaho an interview with the co-creator Chris Sanders. He shares why he chose Ohana as the backbone for his story. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. The high costs of prescription drugs is something that many families struggle with across the country. Here in Hawaii, a recent bill passed by the state legislature now awaits a signature from the governor. Who would it help, and how soon might it make a difference? Here to talk about it is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
So what is 340B?
Yeah, I think to understand the issue that we're talking about, we have to start with this program, 340B. It's a federal program that requires pharmaceutical companies to sell drugs to hospitals that care for disadvantaged populations at a discounted rate. And so qualifying health centers pay a discounted rate for the medication, but then are reimbursed by the insurance companies at a regular rate, which allows the hospital's margin of revenue to increase. And so there are 15 hospitals that qualify in Hawaii, and all federally qualified health centers and Native Hawaiian health centers are also a part of this kind of cohort. And so about 2 years ago, drug companies stopped allowing 340B at contract pharmacies. And contract pharmacies are basically like your neighborhood Long's drugstore or like Walgreens, like one of these like pharmacies in your area, or there's like mom and pop ones too. Instead, pharmacies only allowed hospitals to participate in the program. So like the pharmacy that's like attached to the hospital. So think when you're like leaving like Queens or something, there's the pharmacy in there. That's the only one that would have like qualified for 340B. Here's Hawaii Healthcare Association President Hilton Rathel.
The impact is to the hospitals, the Native Hawaiian health centers, and the federally qualified health centers. Now for the hospitals, this is an impact roughly of about $50 million a year. This is money that they were able to get access to because of these discounts that was cut off starting about 2 years ago. So the hospitals and these other entities, qualifying entities, they were able to participate in this program. They're able to take advantage of these discounts for when they were buying the drugs through this program, distributing them through these contract pharmacies. The pharmaceutical companies have been clamping down on that, restricting that flow of funds, and so it has been cut off over the last couple of years.
So what do these cost savings go toward?
Right, and so one of the centers I spoke with, Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center Director of Pharmacy, Eileen Hallstone, says they use the funds from the 340B program to support their community services.
Here at the center, the loss of the 340B revenue, as you had said, would force difficult decisions that could affect the healthcare of patients with few resources that they already have. And these funds are not theoretical. They really help fund important services. With the 340B savings, right, we invested directly back into our community. The things that we do extra for our community that's at no cost to our patients, we still do them, but it's just stretching it very thin. We still do the medication therapy management. We still do things like blister packing for free for our patients who have issues being compliant with their medication taking. So it's like memory care, things like that. So we still do that, but it's hard. It's going to be hard to keep on maintaining that.
So it sounds like it's really about supporting these health centers in a very holistic way.
Right, right. And it's because these health centers and these hospitals that are part of this program, they're all serving patients who are underserved patients who are very vulnerable. You know, some of them, some of this, these extra funds can go toward patients who are under or uninsured. About 4% of Hawaii residents have no health insurance, and they're still, you know, they still need to receive the care. If they come to the hospital, they're still going to be taken care of. And so these hospitals and these federally qualified health centers, you know, they have to make up the difference there somehow. And I think that that was the original intention of 340B when this was initiated about 20 years ago. And so because these pharmaceutical companies have clamped down on these contract pharmacies, which is honestly most of the ways that people do go to pick up their prescriptions, that's why state lawmakers passed a law this past session that would bar pharmaceutical companies from imposing those types of restrictions on contract pharmacies. Over 10 other states have implemented similar laws requiring drug companies to allow these contract pharmacies to participate in the 340B program.
I have to imagine this has generated some pushback from pharmaceutical companies or some responses from them?
Yeah. And so I spoke with I emailed back and forth with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America spokesperson, Reed Porter. And he wrote in an email that drug companies actually implemented these types of restrictions over concerns of large hospitals and chain pharmacies abusing the program because they say there's not enough oversight to prove that these cost savings are actually going to patient and community care. And, you know, there have been some reports of this happening in areas like the New York Times put out this very long report about this happening in Virginia. But in a committee hearing during the legislative session when they were talking about implementing this new law to restrict the pharmacies from being able to, you know, no longer do 340B for contract pharmacies, the pharmaceutical representatives couldn't really point to any direct evidence of abuse of the program in Hawaii specifically. So that's kind of the push and pull there. And so the bill is awaiting governor's signature. And, you know, this bill that they passed also has a lot of data reporting requirements about profits through these contract pharmacies that are all baked into the bill that will have to be basically, you know, kind of talked about and reported to the legislature after this bill if it becomes law. So governor hasn't really said whether or not he will sign it yet, but the State Health Planning Development Agency and the Department of Health both testified in support of the measure. And, you know, governor has until June 24th to notify the legislature if he intends to veto that measure.
Has he given any indication that he would do so? It seems like he might.
Yeah, he hasn't said anything specific, but seeing like the Department of Health, part of, you know, his administration, also the State Health Planning Development Agency, you know, giving their kind of support for this measure, I think it seems more likely than not that he will sign it into law. There's other ways too that this could pass, even if he doesn't sign it. If he doesn't sign it, it actually does go into law automatically if he does not veto it by, I think, around early July is the deadline for that. And if he does decide to veto any law or any bill that came out of the legislative session this year, basically the legislature can come back and override that veto with a 3/4 majority in each, like the House and the Senate.
It sounds to me like one of the key points here is the concerns of the pharmaceutical companies didn't really have any underpinnings or any evidence there. And so that should sort of more or less feels like clear the way for this to be a good development.
Right. And I think also because these hospitals were, you know, serving these underserved patients, they need these funds. They're saying that they do need these funds to continue doing that and continue doing that work.
Yeah, critical work. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that, Ashley. Really appreciate it. We've been talking with HPR's Ashley Mizuo about the 340B program, which serves disadvantaged populations offering prescription drugs at a discounted rate.
When you support HPR, you support informed, inspired, and connected communities across the Hawaiian Islands. These essential building blocks to our community are now under threat with proposals to cut federal funding to public media. Stand up for HPR and for public media. visit hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
The World Beer Cup is known in the business of brewing as the Olympics of beer, and an Oahu company outplaced hundreds of entries around the world at this year's competition. Josh Kopp is the owner and brewing operations manager at Hanakoa Brewing Company. They translate the Hawaiian phrase to mean continuously working toward your craft. The Conversation's Maddie Bender stopped by the tap room yesterday and spoke with Kopp about what the recognition means.
It's something that we've been working towards for a long time, and it's something I've wanted since I got into the industry in 2014. It was pretty crazy. Everybody here was going, okay, all the brewers were going nuts, and everybody in the tap room was like, what's going on? Why is there so much yelling?
Why does it mean so much to you?
You have to nail it to where it's like, these are the parameters of what the beer has to be. So you're brewing to style, meeting that criteria. B, you have to execute it from a technical perspective. That means that the way that you're brewing, the way that you're doing all the fermentation, and then especially your packaging, you need to make sure that's the best that it can be. And then you get to the next tricky part, which is, how do you get the beer there? How do you protect the beer on its way over there? You could put it in a flat rate box and throw some packing foam in there if you want and just call it a day, but we'll literally get a box that has insulated thermals, throw ice packs in, insulate that, tape it, store it in the cooler, get it as cold as possible, then get it to FedEx the next day. It ships today, and we see, okay, it got there, and it's trying to literally be like, I have to carry this baby across the hill and make sure it gets there alive. So it's a lot of effort, work, and you're combing through, what should we do differently? How do we want to approach this? Does this beer fit this style category? As much as it's like, the metal is not going to necessarily be like, cool, now you're going to make a ton of money off this beer. It's more so just the pride aspect of, we were able to do this. It's not necessarily something I think the general public's going to go crazy for, but it's something that as brewers, we take a lot of pride in. Two of our beers, Metal Rice Breaker, which is our staple pilsner, we actually collaborate with the Rice Factory, who's across the street from us on it. That took bronze in International Lager. And then the other beer that won was How to Make Friends. It's a hazy IPA, and that was in the hazy or juicy IPA category. And that was the largest category at 290 entries, and we got silver. So that was the big one. And we heard the Rice Breaker first, and we were so excited because year after year, it had always made it to the last round of judging, which is usually the final 10, and it never would make it past it. We've changed categories multiple times, and then finally we're like, oh, we finally got the right category. It was really satisfying. And honestly, How to Make Friends winning, I crumbled to my knees. I was like, what just happened?
What's next for Hanakoa? What's next for you guys?
Right now, it's trying to keep up. It's definitely been really great to see that we have been continuing to grow, and it's been awesome with all of our wholesale vendor partners and just the people that have come in. It's been growing, and that's great. There's definitely some projects that I would really love to do, but we're trying to just keep up with the things we need to do and essentially to make this where all the brewers here enjoy it and we're all having fun. Is you have beers that pay the bills, you have beers that feed the hype, and then you have the beers that are close to your soul. And so a lot of us have talked about, oh, if I could do any beer, what would I do? And there's a few that I'd really love to do. I don't know if we'll get to do them within the next 2 years, but we'll see.
Can you share just one of those beers for the soul?
Yeah, I'll do two. So one that I'd really love to do would be a low alcohol French lager and try to build that ratatouille moment of having this beer, and it makes you feel like you're sitting at a cafe in Paris. It's like you're having fresh bread or a croissant. You drink that and it makes you feel like, oh yeah, it takes me back to being at a cafe. I'd ideally like to get these French hops, a Schlitzel Spalt and Aramis. If it's possible, I'm going to try to see if I can source a French grown malt and do that, and then really try to make something that's just encapsulating of petite fleur or small flower kind of thing. The other thing I really want to do, which I don't know if it's possible, but I've done some research, is basically it's just all rice. We throw enzymes in, we ferment on beer yeast and like dry hop it and make this literal, like, it's a gluten-free beer with just rice. There's a lot of things to it mechanically that would be tough. Rice being as gummy as it can be, like, I'm nervous that it'll clog a couple things, and so I want to push the limits on how much rice we can put in just a beer. Get to 50%, and if 50% works, then go and do the other stuff.
That was HPR's Maddie Bender talking with Josh Kopp, the owner of Hanakoa Brewing Company. After the break, Maddie takes a tour of the brewery, and she asks Josh about the T word on everyone's mind. That's right, tariffs. Stay with us. Let's get back to Hanakoa Brewing Company's Josh Kopp. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender. We pick up in the company's brewery.
We're gonna walk around back here a little bit. Are you guys cool with that?
The room is filled with gleaming machinery and massive tanks, the largest of which is 18 feet tall and can hold nearly 2,000 gallons of liquid. It's all for brewing beer. The process goes like this. Pulverized grain and water is pumped through an industrial-grade filter, then boiled. The mass gets spun around and cooled down, then yeast is added. That's technically the moment the mixture becomes beer. And Josh Kopp would know, since he started home brewing when he was 20. He walked me through the steps of brewing the company's flagship award-winning beer, the Ricebreaker Pilsner.
Basically what we do first is all of the grain and rice gets loaded into here. The grain that we use for Ricebreaker is a Weiermann Pilsner. It comes from Bamberg, Germany. It's a really awesome Pilsner malt. There are some domestic substitutes you can use, but honestly, like, I prefer using the Weiermann. There's a character in there that just comes off a lot softer than other ones. From there, it goes over to our mill. It's a hammer mill, so it basically has these rotating knives that'll pulverize it into a flour till it fits through this sieve. And then it collects in a little case, and then it gets conveyed through this white PVC pipe over the brew house. Inside there's like a corkscrew called an auger, and it conveys it over. From there, it pretty much enters the mash tun over here, so water will intersect with the grain as it's coming in, hydrate it. It's like making dough. You don't want clumps of flour or anything like that. They actually call it doughing in too. But one thing that's kind of unique on Ricebreaker is we actually take it through different temperature rests. We have to do a lower temperature rest because of the rice to convert some of the larger starches. And then we bring it up to a temperature where that starch to sugar conversion starts. But it's really producing all these like short chain sugars that are kind of like poo-poos that are really easy for the yeast to eat. And then we take it up a little bit higher and hold it there. So it's a little more like, oh, here's like entrees for you guys to consume. And then after that temperature rest, we go up to a temperature where it stops that enzymatic activity and makes it where it's easier to kind of move the mash from there into these series of plates. Basically, this is the back plate, so all the mash flows through this bottom hole, and then it enters this void here. So like once this is filled up and there's back pressure on it, liquid just flows through this and goes through the other side, and then starts going into the kettle in the center.
So this is like, I mean, they're plates, but it looks like basically a huge strainer.
Yeah, pretty similar, like just a giant mechanical pressurized colander. And then from there, we're boiling. We actually use both German and New Zealand hops in there. The German hops give a little bit more floral and soft lemon. The New Zealand Motueka hops have a little bit more like zippy lemon and lime zest kind of deal going on. And then it'll go from the whirlpool through a series of plumbing through a device called a heat exchanger. So the cold water will run through these plates, the hot liquid will run the other side, and then there's a thermal exchange. And then we actually recollect that hot water that comes back to use for brewing later. The oxygen gets added and it's flowing into the tank. For a Ricebreaker, believe it or not, it's usually these two tanks. Every 3 weeks, we're filling them and emptying them. It's a six-week beer. Even our director of operations was like, you wanted to make a lager, our flagship beer, that takes 6 weeks. And it was like, yeah. But it's worked out pretty well, thankfully.
A couple things I noticed as you were walking through the steps here. The first is just like the range of places that all these materials come from. Germany, New Zealand, what about the tanks and equipment itself? Where does that come from?
So our brew house was actually manufactured in, it was in Wisconsin. Most of the tanks were like welded in Wisconsin, but then there's also like Alfa Laval, which is from Italy, like all the heat exchangers. That mash filter is from Belgium. There's just a lot of stuff. There's stuff from Siemens in there, so German. All our fermenters are from Premier Stainless. They're based out of Escondido, California, which is north of San Diego. These tanks are manufactured in China by HGM. In fact, those big tanks, I actually got those ordered in February 2024 because the minute that election season started, I was like, I need to get these before the election is over. And because of the way the economy's been in the brewing industry, those big tanks were cheaper than my smaller tanks because China has just had a surplus of stainless steel because their housing market basically came to a halt. I'm glad I got it when I did, because if there was 145% tariffs on these tanks, I definitely wouldn't have gotten them. And they've become necessary for what we're doing now, so it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's just the considerations for all these different moving parts. If, knock on wood, something breaks, you have to get a replacement. People might not be thinking where some of this stuff comes in. And so, like, would you ever think about passing on some of those costs or offsetting, and how you would do that?
The hard part is right now, like, people don't really have a lot of purchasing power in Hawaii already. Like, most times, like, even for what you make in Hawaii versus the cost of living isn't the same as what you make in, like, even a state like California versus the cost of living. That's definitely popping on there. But with that being said, like, it's really awesome that we have like a customer base that wants to keep coming and drinking these beers, because it is a little bit more expensive. We have tried doing it where beers like Rice Breaker or Break Time Blonde, like, and Rooftop Pale Ale, we open the brewery with Break Time Blonde at $6.50 a pint and Rooftop $7.50 a pint, and I'm never changing that. I want people to be able to come in, get a beer, maybe a snack or something, like, even if you don't have a lot to spend right now, because part of the reason we want to do this was I know everybody in the world needs a break. With all these costs going up, there's some things that we're doing to be more creative in terms of like how we're using the ingredients. Like, what are we really getting out of this thing that we're spending so much money on? Is it worth that? And trying to make beers where it's like, we have beers that are like, these are economical beers that we do in large volumes. And then these are like, nobody will care about the cost. It's a small batch. Do whatever we want. It's okay. Like, give people the option rather than just being like, you know, we're a one tier sort of shop.
Meeting people where they're at, kind of.
Well, and also, if we were to raise our prices, I don't know who is going to get priced out of it. And the last thing I want to do is be a part of the pricing people out of paradise. You know, I talked about Weyermann Pilsner and I want to keep using it. I know that's already going to go up in price because of the tariff on Europe. And I have a threshold where once it hits this, it's like, I got to sub it, and I know what my sub is. And I understand the idea behind what this administration wants to do in terms of, let's bring these manufacturing jobs back and all this other stuff. But this is not, in my opinion, the way to execute it, because you're essentially putting the roadblock in when it's going to take 4 to 5 years of investment for anybody to really build something that's going to then meet that demand there. So all it does is create a scramble. I mean, you can kind of see across the entire brewing industry, people kind of freaking out about all this, and people will say, well, we'll just raise our prices, but beer isn't as elastic as something like an iPhone or a car even. Food in general has been this thing where this is in my head what I should be paying for it. You know, one thing we can't get away from is an aluminum tariff. That's going to be really big, but that's why our business model is based on doing a lot of draft sales for wholesale rather than focusing on pushing a lot of cans. And yeah, I don't know, being on an island, and especially during COVID, it really kind of forced us to have to be aware of geopolitics and logistics in general, and trying to think about like, how is all of this going to affect our ability to acquire these items? Or like, I asked one of our vendors, like, what comes through the Taiwan Strait as soon as that blockade happened for War Games? And they were kind of like, why are you concerned about that? And I was like, because that could happen. We get rice from Japan, and if something happens and it's like, we can't send this because XYZ, it's like, okay, well, we're not going to be able to get this anymore. So there's a lot of uncertainty for what's going on in the world. I think some people like that, but I think a lot of us really want to have the certainty that we can wake up, go to work, pretty much the same thing every day in terms of like, not like, ah, and just kind of have time for family and friends.
Let's narrow into aluminum for just a second if you can. So just like, where does it come from? Process for all of that? What types of increases are you potentially looking at?
We're for sure expecting an aluminum increase. We don't actually buy cans from Ball on Island because they don't produce a 16-ounce can. It's only a 12-ounce. The aluminum that we're getting is Canadian aluminum from Crown, and there's really not much we can do about those prices going up. Then with malt, that is going up in price, mainly because of anything that's imported. And the problem's going to be that if people are like me and it's like, this is my threshold, and it hits, we're all going to go to domestic malt, and they're going to have to increase their prices to meet that demand. And they're not going to be able to ramp up to meet that demand immediately. So there's going to be a lot of chaos taking place in terms of that.
And then just like the other overarching thing that I noticed about your business is that making a beer is at least a 6-week process. So if you have a price increase at the beginning of that, when you're still in the materials phase, that's going to affect the entire run.
Like, honestly, I don't want to increase our prices even if things happen. It's, hey, this is the price, we have to work within it, which has been a fun challenge. But at the same time, if people would buy it at that price point, like, that would be great. But I already know it's like, if I can't afford this stuff because the price of everything else is going up, neither can everybody else.
But then it's like, what gives? Does that just hurt your bottom line? Like, you eat any of those increases?
Kind of have to, I think, for now. If you're in a position where you can raise those prices and your market responds positively to it, then that's great. But I don't see us doing that right away, because one, it's never good to be the first person to do it. And two, it also comes down to, like, in the beer, like, is this nice to have or is it need to have? Rice Breaker, the rice, Yume Pirica, it has to be in there. No matter what that price increase is, we're working around that price increase. But, like, you know, even our Pale Ale Rooftop used to be Weyermann Pilsner. I really love this product that we get from Yakima Chief Hops called Hyper Boost, which is expensive. But every time we haven't used it to see and test, I felt like the beer has lost something. So I said, I'm going to sub out Weyermann Pilsner for RAR 2 Row, which is a lower price point item. It's a good product. We use it in a lot of our other beers. But it basically means we have all this other cash available while maintaining our margins to allocate towards something else we really want. I think that's going to be the game for this year, and I hope it's still the game for 2026. I really hope it doesn't get to a ridiculous place, and I kind of doubt it will. There's been a lot of pushback for things lately on these tariffs. I just think everybody's over the chaotic aspect of it.
That was HPR's Matty Bender and Josh Kopp, the owner of Hanakoa Brewing Company. How are tariffs affecting your favorite snacks and drinks? Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org and let us know. Time for another installment of What's in Your Cart. Earlier this week, we visited a Time supermarket in Honolulu, just off of King Street, where we met Nelson Smith. He wore a Red Sox cap and might still have his Boston accent, but he's lived in Hawaii for decades and honed his shopping habits to fit his budget. Nelson talked about one particular price increase that's hit particularly close to home, and he revealed a nickname he's carried for most of his life.
I've shopped already, and I was expecting bananas to be up because that was in the news, and they're still $1.39 a pound.
So presently surprised.
Get that potassium.
Have you come across that before in terms of places where you expected prices to be higher because everybody's talking about it, but really not going up?
No. Of course, milk is the biggest, $9 a gallon. I always ask friends from the mainland, how much are you paying for milk? And they complain it's up to $3. I said, let me tell you something.
Cry me a river.
Yeah. So I go to Walmart and get the reduced. Although Walmart has been in the news too.
Right, for having to possibly raise prices soon, right?
And to eat the tariff, yeah.
So do you do that? Do you sort of spread out your shopping to different stores according to sort of what you want to get and where you think it might be less expensive?
Well, I've been here long enough. I know which place to go to for whatever. The prices haven't really spiked.
Are there any items in particular that you've noticed? You mentioned eggs and milk, but like thinking about baseline, are there things that you remember getting, say, 6 months ago, a year ago at a certain price, and now it's just drastically different?
Cake. I'm a big cake eater, and so I love to pick up a piece of cake every now and then, and I've noticed those prices have been sneaking up, and the portion's getting smaller at the same time.
Squeezing into both ends, more expensive and a smaller portion.
From both sides, yeah.
Oh man, and that's hard when you're trying to satisfy the sweet tooth.
Yeah, I do, yeah. They used to call me the cake man.
That was Nelson Smith, otherwise known as the cake man, who lives in Honolulu. Have you noticed that any of your favorite items have gone up in price lately, or shrunk in size, or both? We want to hear from you. Give us a call on our talkback line or write us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. More housing is on the way for Maui fire survivors. Since August, more than 600 call Kalaiʻōla home, and organizers say that the development is ramping up. Here to tell us about it is Catherine Kluwert-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So some good news out of Maui in terms of more housing available, no?
Yeah, so Kalaiʻōla has been being worked on and, as you mentioned, in development for quite a number of months now, and it is nearing completion. So it's a development that is being managed by Home Aid Hawaii, and it's in partnership with the state of Hawaii. So it's distinct from the Kilohana Temporary Housing, which is a similar arrangement, but that is developed by FEMA nearby. So Kalaiʻōla is a 450-unit modular housing development, and it is intended to be temporary. So up to 5 years, folks will be able to live there. And when it's complete, it'll be able to house about 1,500 fire survivors. Cesar Martinez is the Home Aid site director, and he says currently they're at 644 residents. 244 of those units are occupied at this time, and that's about a little over 225 households that are moved in and living there. So phase one of the project is complete, and they're currently finishing up phase two. It's getting really close to being done. The homes are in clusters called pods, and so it really is set up to try and create community. And, you know, a lot of families are living there. Kids are playing together. Martinez says two pods are left to be set up over the next month or 6 weeks. And, you know, we've been hearing a lot about ongoing transportation of this modular housing from the Kahului Harbor into Lahaina. That is, you know, getting close to wrapping up. They've been bringing in these modular housing units usually at nighttime. And, you know, once they get on site, the units are cleaned, inspected, prepared for families to move in, connected to infrastructure, water, electric, all of those things. And Martinez explains the resources that are available there for residents.
We offer a lot of services, and we're still bringing a lot of services here to site so people could get informed, get help. We have, I think, the Maui food truck coming in on Wednesday, along with the vet clinic. We have Piha Wellness for mental health. We also are trying to launch financial literacy classes so people could get a head start and kind of figure out what they want to do in their near future. We're also letting residents know, you know, let's not wait till the 5-year mark till you start looking for a place. If you find something, go ahead and secure it so that you guys can have something past those 5 years. We don't want the housing to be kind of diminished by the time everyone starts looking for homes. So we just have to educate our residents and make sure everyone's on the same page.
Such a good reminder that housing is that central thing that everyone needs, but there are all these wraparound services that go into it as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's nice for residents there to have a lot of those right on site. Kalaiʻiʻola is located on 57 acres in Lahaina, and fire-displaced families, as Martinez mentioned, can live there for up to 5 years. And then the property will be turned over to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands for their use afterward. And so homes, you know, we've been seeing these sort of futuristic units there on site. They're called nano nests. They have a lot of glass, and those are a big part of Kalaiʻiʻola. But there's actually 5 different providers that are being used that are offering the units that are coming in. So they look all different. You know, others look more traditional. And prior to this, some of these families were still living in hotels, you know, up until really recently. It's really hard to believe that, you know, coming up on 2 years after the fire, you know, these folks really didn't have stable housing up until now. You know, others were in Airbnbs or other temporary rentals. And so they were selected through an application process, which is now closed. And a lot, you know, as Martinez mentioned, a lot of, you know, community events, activities along with those resources. They hosted an Easter event that he said more than 400 people came out to. And Martinez is a fire survivor himself, and he lives on site. And so he, you know, he shared a lot about that, really that sense of community that residents at Kalaiʻiʻola are feeling as they settle in. Zoe Chesson is a Kalaiʻiola resident who was born and raised in Lahaina, and she and her husband have 2 young kids. She talked in an interview with Homemade about how great it's been for their kids to play with other kids and, you know, how there's this really neighborhood feeling there.
Our neighbors have been amazing. That's something, I'm sure you get that in other places, but it's special about Lahaina. A lot of the people that live really close to us in here, I didn't know before the fire, or, you know, maybe saw them in passing. And now we're all great friends, and we all share vegetables that we grew in our garden, or, you know, they think about each other. And I love that. You know, it's thoughtful. It's, hey, I went to pick up a grocery bag and I grabbed an extra one for you because I was thinking, and that's super special. And that's one of the things that makes Lahaina so special before and now. And it's nice to see that that hasn't gone away, that people are still looking out for each other. And this space has done that, brought people together to continue to be neighbors.
So we're looking at 244 units occupied out of 450 units altogether. That's about halfway there. Do we have a sense of the totality of the timeline that we're looking at here?
You know, that's a good question. He said the units will be all, you know, in place over the next month or 6 weeks. You know, it sounds like it takes a little while for those units to be set up. You know, maybe there's some basic furnishings that are put in for folks, you know, just getting them ready. And then, you know, hopefully the remainder of those residents will be able to move in, you know, over the next few months. I don't have a really final timeline on that. But, you know, I know that that's the goal. It, you know, he talked about just trying to get people settled in as soon as possible.
And trying to build out the community a little bit too there too, beyond the housing, no?
Absolutely. You know, he said he talked about a playground installation coming up for the residents' kids, and offering some extra offices for more on-site resources and support. So a lot more things coming in for the community there over the next year or so.
Fantastic. Well, we appreciate the update, and we're going to be wishing everyone in the community well.
Thank you so much, DW.
We've been hearing from HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwert-Pachtel. Look for her stories on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Disney's live-action Lilo and Stitch hits theaters tomorrow, so we're reflecting on an interview with the co-creator of the original Lilo and Stitch animated film. It debuted in 2002 as the first feature-length animated film to be set in Hawaii, and it made waves at the box office and among critics. Today, we honoho an interview with the co-writer and director of the Lilo and Stitch animated film, Chris Sanders. HPR's Russell Sobiono spoke with Sanders in 2022. He reflects on the success of the film 20 years down the road.
Aloha, 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 aloha. from the first day of writing the script to the day it was released in theaters. Did you at any time think it would achieve the level of success that it did?
I was hopeful, but of course you don't know that. Yeah. I would say, though, that a lot of the things that created Lilo and Stitch were from Mulan. And so one of the aspects that I hoped for Lilo and Stitch was that it would have the staying power. I hoped to create something that would really just be ubiquitous and that would stick around. And that's what happened with Lilo and Stitch. Stitch in particular, when I go to Florida and I visit Disney World, I can go into different stores. And even here at Disneyland, I go into a store, they might have an entire section of the store devoted to Stitch, and only more so every year. And so the thing about that that I am so grateful for and so proud of and just still so amazed by is that he really had this ability to join the core of that Disney universe. So you can buy a picture frame and Mickey and Minnie and Donald and Stitch will be on the frame. And that just, it's so thrilling to me because that character has been embraced by people in a way that I really and truly could only have hoped for.
One other thing in the movie that is uniquely Hawaiian is that you chose as the center of the movie this idea of ohana.
Ohana means family. Family means nobody gets left behind.
Was ohana something you knew about prior to writing the movie?
I have come to believe there's a destiny for these films, I guess would be the way to say it. I don't want to get too all hoogly-woogly about it, but no, it wasn't there in the beginning. The genesis of Lilo and Stitch was partially that I wanted to create a film around the idea of a villain becoming a hero. So we spend a lot of time killing villains at the end of Disney films. And this time I thought, let's change that up. I want a villain that becomes the hero. So we have this little guy, and I was looking for a place to set the film. And originally I was thinking like maybe rural Kansas or something. And there was a reason for that. I didn't want to like really gather a crowd. It was a reaction to Mulan, where we were moving like armies of people and we were dealing with cities full of people. And logistically, that can be pretty tiring. So I thought, okay, next film, smaller population. And as I was working on Lilo and Stitch, developing it and getting ready to pitch the idea, I looked up at my wall and I had a map of Hawaii because I had recently visited. And it took me a while, a few hours. And suddenly I thought, wait a minute, that's a place that has an intimacy. And why wouldn't I just set it there as a story? There was something so like magical about it. I was kind of resistant to it, even just myself. I was like, can I do that? It's weird to say that. And I thought, yeah, why not? Why not set this in Hawaii? After we screened the film for the first time, just for ourselves in story sketch form, we didn't have any animation. We just do it all in story sketch first. We were looking at this film and we were seeing this character change from bad to good, but we didn't have a reason. He was changing from bad to good pretty much just because it was our plan. Like, he became good. And after the first screening, I was the one that said, we don't have the engine yet. We have all these things, but we need the engine. We need the reason that he becomes good. And we realized that Stitch has a family that loves him and that that was the thing that would change him. The idea of ohana was the perfect thing to place around this character. And that would be the thing that would change him, that would change the course of his life. We didn't know originally, but by complete just accident, I put Stitch in the one place that had the best, most beautiful interpretation of family ever.
Did you have to talk to people from Hawaii or did you have to come to Hawaii to do a little bit more research as to how deep it goes or how inclusive it can be?
We did. We came to Hawaii, but we also continued to make connections with everyone that we could and that we needed to. So when it came to the music and the culture and the language, we cast as many people as we could that knew what they were doing. And we found as many people, like a good example would be the Kumuhula. He staged the dance sequences that we videotaped and gave to the animators because we understood from those connections that this is something that you've got to get it right. You do not mess around with this. It's not my culture, but I'm in charge of getting it right. So Mark Keili'i Ho'omalu was our kumuhula, and you know, he told us everything we needed to know about everything. He was one of those people that gave us more than we ever could have hoped for, culturally, language-wise, just stories, everything. But he also co-wrote some of the music with Alan Silvestri. Mahalo. So he's just the perfect example. But we had many, many people that we got together with. We also partnered with the Kamehameha School, and their choir is the choir that sings in the movie, for example. So that was just, for us, an exercise in humility and letting people who know what they're doing help us.
And speaking about local voices, I wanted to ask you about the actors that you chose to voice the characters. This movie came out a year after Shrek, which I get the feeling that that was kind of a big turning point in animated feature, where more and more well-known movie actors started getting cast for these voiceover roles. But your movie didn't really go after the most famous actors out there. In fact, you got some real locals to voice some of the characters. You got Tia Carrere, you got Jason Scott Lee.
You sure it's a dog?
Uh-huh. He used to be a collie before he got ran over.
How's it, Nani?
Did you catch fire again?
Nah, just the stage. Listen, I was wondering, if you're not doing anything this...
David, I told you, I can't. Look, I gotta go. The kid at table 3 is throwing poi again. Maybe some other time, okay?
Don't worry. She likes her butt and fancy hair. I know. I read her diary.
You got Kuneva Mook, who you were just talking about. Was it a conscious decision to cast Hawaiians to voice the Hawaiian characters?
Yeah, there are two sides of that question. But the first, most important one was, yes, we found as many people that we could that were from Hawaii. The only one that we struggled with was the character of Lilo. And we had casting directors scour Hawaii. At that time, we couldn't find the right voice. And that was a very, very difficult voice to cast. Even here in the mainland, it was Dean Deblois. He was my co-writer and co-director, and we partnered in everything on this film. We worked so hard looking for the right voice. And you get to the point where you think, are we just going to have to settle for like an okay voice, you know? And it's weird because it's elusive. I'll know it when I hear it, you know? And one day this girl came in and her name was DeVay Chase, and she sat at the microphone and she started doing her thing. And Dean and I looked at each other and we knew we had found her. So that was the only voice that we really wished we could have cast from Hawaii, and we gave it a shot. It wasn't in the cards at that time. On the subject of famous versus non-famous, we get pressure sometimes from the studio, but I think that we found the perfect cast.
And continuing to speak about voices, in addition to coming up with the idea for the film and co-directing and co-writing it, you're also the voice of Stitch. And it's an interesting choice, something that can be both cute and scary at the same time, I think. How'd you come up with the voice for Stitch?
Originally, the concept was that he wouldn't speak at all. He might make a few little noises like growls and stuff, but he would never speak. As we worked on the film, it became obvious that he would have to talk. And sometimes he would be talking more than we wished he would, but he had to for the role. As we pitched the early storyboards, when I pitched my boards, I would just give that character that voice. It's a voice that I would use to call people on the phone and annoy them. And just, it was just this dumb voice I used from time to time when it felt right. But eventually we were talking about, Stitch's voice. And Dean said, well, why don't we just use yours? You're not famous and you're not going to cause trouble. Because the concern on Dean and my part was that if we did hire Robert Redford or Robin Williams, and they only had like 15 lines, and even those lines were like two words at a time, right? That there might be some trouble that would develop from that. It would be very easy to imagine that eventually the studio would come around and say, well, if you got Robin Williams or Robert Redford, why don't you give them a bigger role? And that would be a disaster, because that would mean that we were moving the film and pointing it in the wrong direction just to placate somebody, right? And we didn't know that that was going to happen, but we thought, let's ensure that we'd never even have to have that discussion by putting somebody like me in that role. And nobody wants more of me, right? So it was perfect.
Is it something that you can go in and out of, or is it something you have to warm up to?
No, I can just go in and out of it.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Do you think Moana could have been made without Lilo and Stitch?
I'd never thought about that before. I like the idea that maybe we've paved the way for things, and that maybe the idea that was like, you know, the idea that you don't have to do one film in one place and then you can never visit it again. So I was really excited that Moana was revisiting that region.
I rewatched the film last night, and I probably haven't seen it since I took my kids to see it in theaters 20 years ago. And I was reminded just how strong the theme of family is that runs through it. And I just love that it's not just this picturesque idea of a family, but that how family is sometimes just a group of people who love each other for who they are. Mm. When you look back over the years, how do you feel about the legacy of Lilo and Stitch?
I'm so proud of it. And you know, we were busy doing certain things. And you're so busy making this film and getting all the story problems worked out that you don't necessarily think about the larger impact that it might have. And one of the wonderful things about something like Lilo and Stitch making a movie is that it endures. It has this staying power. And over the years, more and more people see it for the first time. And over the years, both Dean and I have heard from people who have been touched by this film in various ways, and it has really meant something to them. And that's just absolutely so exciting. And yeah, films will find their audience, and it's just always going to be out there. That's the neat thing about animation. Animation is not the easiest thing to make. It's a very labor-intensive thing, and it takes many, many years to get one made. But once it's made, it sticks around, and it continues to speak to people, and that's just, it's amazing, and it's wonderful.
Right on. Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, take it easy.
That was the voice of Stitch, on demand no less, Chris Sanders, who's also the co-director and co-writer of the animated film Lilo and Stitch. He spoke with HPR's Russell Sobiono back in 2022. Fast forward to now, Sanders reprises his role in the live-action remake, which opens in Hawaii theaters tomorrow. HPR's Cassie Ordonio caught up with the Stitch OG this week, and her story is available online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we revisit some of our recent stories about tariffs. Give us some feedback on how the T word is affecting your life. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm D.W. Gibson. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. Thank you.